Welcome to the Marketplace, No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow from the Yawkey Theater at WGBH in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Tess Vigeland. You know, elections are about a lot of things, as we all know, but they come down to this, numbers. So, Kai, let's do the numbers.
I think we shall. We have, as of today, 27 days until the election. And I don't know if you've noticed, but one of your former state officials here in the state of Massachusetts running ads all over the country, guys looking for a new job, and a Senate race that goes back and forth. What, can you people not make up your mind?
Yeah, you know, in fact, both of your candidates have signed pledges to ban third-party ads from their race, so you do not have the pleasure of those honest and highly complimentary super PAC ads from groups that... I don't know. I think they kind of sound like a workout video. You know, you've got Joe Sixpack and Feel the Heat and Restore Our Future, just to name a few.
Those are real, by the way.
Those are real, yep.
So tonight, the economics of getting your vote and some of the issues you might want to be paying attention to the next time you hear these two guys.
We can choose a future where we export more products and outsource fewer jobs. After a decade that was defined by what we bought and borrowed, we're getting back to basics. And doing what America's always done best, we are making things again.
That America, that united America, can unleash an economy that will put Americans back to work, that will once again lead the world with innovation and productivity, and that will restore every father and mother's confidence that their children's future is brighter even than the past.
All right, so of course, Governor Romney and President Obama. And, you know, elections usually have a theme, right? There's foreign policy, national security. This time around, as we all know, it is the economy, due in no small part to the near global financial collapse of a few years ago. So we've got jobs, we've got taxes, the deficit, the middle class. But what's really most important here is what's behind those numbers, the stories behind those numbers. And that's really why we're here today and why we're traveling across the country this month.
We are taking the time, as Tess has been talking about, to explain what often just gets passed along as talking points. Like that piece of tape, those two guys. Amazing how similar they sounded, wasn't it? Kind of extraordinary. This election is about so many things that are so much more important than who's ahead in which poll and by how much. It's not the horse race that matters. It is, as we like to say, the economy, smarty pants. But riddle me this. What does that even actually mean? So tonight, the Marketplace, No Horse, No Race Election Roadshow. Phil. Wherever you like. You pick. Water for you if you want. Is that good? They make me do everything.
No.
Dude, really?
Sorry.
that I cannot do.
Totally unscripted.
I'm not doing that.
All right, so, you know, there's no question that Governor Romney and President Obama are reaching out to potential voters in a lot of ways that we haven't seen before this particular election cycle. They are doing it through tweets. They are doing it through apps and a whole host of other social media, Facebook, what have you.
But does it really matter? Can we get to know ourselves better and what our political preferences are through what we say to our Twitter followers or on a Facebook post? That's why Bill Powers is here. He's the director of a project called The Crowdwire, which is looking at the influence of social media on the 2012 election. Bill, welcome.
Thank you.
How many Twitter followers do you have, man?
I have 1,200. I'm new. I'm new and I don't tweet that much.
Oh, my God.
How many do you have, Kai?
19,147.
Well done.
But, you know, who's counting?
You know, I'm all about observing the Twitter
followers. Yeah, that's, well, so talk to me about that. What can you, in the broadest sense, what can you tell us about this election when you follow Twitter and Facebook and social media?
Well, first of all, there's a massive explosion of interest in politics on social media. I mean, it is the growth, if you just look at the growth. Yeah. A year ago during the GOP debate season, if 300,000 people responded to a debate on TV among the GOP primary candidates, that was remarkable.
Yeah.
Last week's debate, 11.2 million comments.
Wow.
That's crazy.
On a 90-minute TV event. That's extraordinary.
And, I mean, I have to say, I was watching Twitter during that debate, and quite frankly, a lot of it was more entertaining than the actual debate itself. But, you know, I wonder, though, how you can really measure a candidate's popularity, their actual chances of getting elected, by something where numbers really don't tell a real story, do they?
Well, they don't in the macro sense. Yeah. Most people are not in the world are not tweeting still, but
right.
there are 140 million people who are actively on Twitter mm-hmm. and also commenting on public Facebook, which we also track. So in that sense, it's a significant slice, and it's a new slice, and a very vibrant slice, and you can learn a lot about it. We're not just about volume. I gave you that number, 11.2 million.
Sure.
But we're also about trying to figure out, A, what those people are saying, using algorithms and other sophisticated tools, and B, who they are. You know, demographic slices. We've been finding interesting trends on Twitter of younger people participating in the election in ways that we hadn't expected just because they have this tool, and other groups that really could play a significant role.
How do you know age on Twitter, though? I mean, are you asking all these people
right.
how old
baby,
they are?
Pictures.
Right, so I'm working...
get a good picture.
This project is a non-commercial project, but I'm doing it with a technology company called Bluefin Labs, which is based here in Cambridge.
Huh.
And they have everything each individual has said in public media, social media, archived. And from that archive, you can draw a portrait of each
wow.
person.
Wow.
And so,
that's
for example, if somebody...
Raise your hand. Horrified? Raise your hand. Thank you.
So
okay.
so my next question,
well,
I'm going to use the word yo.
So that's right. Next question, how many of you are on Twitter? Yeah,
awesome.
Yeah.
And here's
yeah.
the good news. We don't yeah. analyze this or report it by name. Okay? So we're just doing it as
Bill
basically citizens
Powers.
On their speaking.
Okay. Yeah.
And what's amazing is that, you know, for example, if someone says my son or my children, we know forevermore that they're a parent. People talk about their jobs. People talk about what TV shows they watch.
This
so
totally makes me rethink my whole Twitter feed.
Uh-huh.
There you go.
Wow.
Hey, you're telling it to all those 19,000 people. You're telling it to me, too.
That's right. Except that I didn't think anybody was actually paying attention. That's the thing. We're gonna get Ryan Enos up here. He's an assistant professor of government at Harvard. Come on up. We're not playing any music. We're just dragging you up. He's an assistant professor of government at Harvard. He studies something that is called quantitative social science. And when we were in Cleveland last week, I made him explain that, and I forgot it right away. So we're not even going to do that. But what I want you to help us understand is how things like what Bill is tracking actually influence the way we vote. I mean, your whole research thing is how proximity to other people influences what you do in the voting booth.
Yeah, so here's one of the fascinating things about how people receive messages about politics, is that we're more likely to accept those messages if it's from people that we can identify with, people we trust, people we think we have something in common with. And that's one of these ways that things like social media might really be changing the way we accept messages about politics or about anything else. Because it used to be a very top-down process, and it could be from somebody we didn't identify with.
Yeah.
Now, if it's somebody that we know shares common interests with us, somebody we may have met, somebody we trust, and they're passing the message to us, we're a lot more likely to accept that message.
I love that line, accepting messages. Sorry, let me just, we're going to take some questions right after these guys are done. So in about 3 or 4 minutes, so raise your hand, the mic runners will come to you, and we'd love to get your thoughts on this one, okay? They're over there and over there. Sorry, Tess.
Yeah, I just wonder, though, how distorted that becomes, though,
right.
because, I mean,
right.
I think one of the biggest criticisms of drawing any conclusions from either Facebook or Twitter is that it's a total echo chamber.
Right.
Sure, that's absolutely true. And it's a brand new medium, and it's something that social science is really struggling to get their heads around. So one thing we don't know, for example, is whether people that are becoming involved in it are people that otherwise would have been involved in politics in a different way, or whether it's
right.
people that are all of a sudden getting involved because of this new medium. And this is why, you know, it's great, these things, these projects we have like Bill's doing, where we're trying to actually apply science to this and figure it out.
Hey, so riddle me this. Do we care why people get involved? Don't we just want people to get involved in a place where voting turnout is like 61% or something?
As right? long as it's bringing new people in. But that's the question. Is it
yeah.
bringing new people in?
Yeah. I want to follow up on Tess's thing. You know how they always say internet surveys are unreliable and because they're self-selected? And if you have it, it's like the listener email box at Marketplace, right? We know when we've struck a chord when people email. But all we ever get are the love letters, right? And then a couple of people who really hate us. And we discount those because you kind of have to. But it's but it's the same thing, right? People who are on Twitter want to be on Twitter, and they want to hear what other people have to say who are on Twitter, right?
Right.
I mean, isn't it?
It's true, but you know, I would take issue with Tess what you said about the echo chamber,
yeah.
because it's also another thing. It's people talking, yes, to people they agree with and trust, but it's also like eavesdropping on a conversation in a bar, where people are being unusually often honest compared to what they might say to a pollster.
Also creepy.
Yes.
Yeah, but that's so funny because I think at least what I hear, and maybe Facebook and Twitter really are so different, but you also hear a lot that Facebook is the place where people are not honest about their lives. And basically all you see on Facebook is all the great things that are happening to people
right.
and what they're doing.
So. But I would say they're pretty sincere about their political views when they speak about them.
Yeah.
That's not image shaping.
Smart as you two guys are, you're not the only ones who are thinking of this stuff. The campaigns, how are they using this? How are they doing it? Ryan, do you have any insight in that?
I mean, they're using it a lot. And the Obama campaign, of course, in 2008 used social media in ways people had never seen, and they ran experiments on it actually to see what worked. And in one great thing about politics, of course, is that anything you do that do well, the other campaign is going to pick up on.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
The Romney campaign learned a lot of those tricks and is using them now.
Wow, that's amazing. All right, so get your hands up and we'll get the mic runner to you. There's one up there. Another question about this is what happens, this isn't actually ever going to happen, but what happens if we stop? I mean, if people think about this and they realize, as I have clearly just done, all the things we're telling people, what if people just start opting out? What do you do?
Opting out of social media?
Yeah.
Can you?
Oh, my God. That is not going to happen. Human beings have such an itch to express themselves.
I believe I heard that about MySpace, though.
Good.
No,
good.
I think that the platforms will come and go, but the need to talk to each other, that's not going anywhere.
All right, let's open it up, actually. Yes, sir.
I'm wondering.
Tell us who you are and where you're from, sir, would you?
I'm Robert. I'm actually originally from Washington, D.C., but I live in Revere over on the east side there. I'm wondering if you, through the different channels of social media, Facebook, Twitter, Google+, whatever, if you can detect a bias within each one of them, whether it be age, mostly I'm talking conservative or liberal, if more people are on one than the other.
Well, there's the public radio chat room, too, but that's a whole different thing.
There is an emerging conventional wisdom that Twitter in particular skews liberal. And there are some days and some data sets when I see that, and I really buy into that. But there are other events and other days when I begin to have doubts about it. And I think it's sort of somewhat of a floating crap game, the whole complexion of Twitter. I do have a sense from some studies we've just done in the last few days that we're going to be publishing soon that there is a kind of a bi-coastal skew to Twitter. There's definitely a younger age skew.
I think there's an East Coast skew.
You'll see when we put this map on the blog, there's quite a bit happening in California.
Really?
Yes.
It's actually funny because I wake up real early, and the first thing I do is turn on my iPhone and I check my Twitter feed, and it's all the people. It's 4:15 in L.A., but the 7:15 in the morning East Coast crowd is cranking, and they go all day.
Yeah.
It's nuts.
But just to answer your question, I would say that the jury's still out, and there has been no definitive study, and it's very hard to do to nail it down because people are on Twitter under other names, and there's a lot of things that have yet to be established.
Yeah. Anybody on this side of the room? Come on, we know you have questions.
While we're waiting for that, then how important are these in the grand scheme of trying to figure out how to run an election and use that information as a candidate?
Let's play it forward, though. Not this year, not 2016, sure. 2020, right?
Yeah, it's any campaign that can stay ahead of social, well, ahead of any media, whatever the next medium is going to be the candidate that has an edge in the next election. And we saw this when television was first invented. You go way back then, it was the candidates that knew how to use television. John F. Kennedy is a famous example that got an edge in that campaign, and that was a really close campaign. So, we can imagine whatever this new future of social media is, be it Twitter or anything else, it's the campaigns that harness that have the edge.
All right, let's get one more quick one there up in the middle in the back somewhere.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is David. I'm from Somerville. My question is about the content of that the candidates are putting out via these social media channels and whether that content differs in some way from the content they're putting out through TV or through debates, whether it's somehow different, more genuine, or is it just like another means through which they can distribute the same talking points that they're distributing through other channels?
I would say that the most interesting specimen to answer your question that you might look at, and I look at this every day, is the Twitter feeds of Romney and Obama. And the different styles with which they're using Twitter and tweeting. And they do really actually sound like themselves, even though Obama's tweets are only really his when they're signed BO.
Right, right.
They have very different, Obama's has been more, in my opinion, more aggressive, kind of really and this is contrasting to his debate performance last week. Generally yeah, speaking, he's been engaging. He feels like he's talking to people on social media. Romney feels like he's making announcements, and it's more sloganistic.
Do you know if Romney actually tweets himself?
I don't know.
Does he sign MR?
No, he doesn't do that.
All right, we got to go. Thank you very much for your questions. Bill Powers, he runs the CrowdWire Project, and Ryan Enos from Harvard, the School of Government. Thanks, you guys,
very
much.
Thank you.
Sorry about your pants, man. Perfect. Whatever you're in. Pick a chair, any chair. Watch out for the water, though.
All right, so some of you may know this, but Boston is a bit of a second home for me. I lived here for 7 years back in the 90s. I was a reporter for Only a Game over, down the street at the other station that shall not be named. I love my Pats. I love my Bruins, my Celtics, and, that baseball team that's looking for a new manager.
So this is a topic that Tess and I have agreed to disagree on. Because
vehemently.
I grew up in New York. And my team is still in the playoffs. Thank you very much. So anyway.
Yeah. Yankees.
No. Family radio show.
Well, our next guest is also in the business of sports, and this rivalry in particular, right? Yes.
Chris Wren is the founder of a company called Sully's Brand. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for coming out. And let's tell everybody what it is that you do.
Well, you know, it's a company.
And let's do it speaking into the microphone.
Thank you.
There we go.
Sully's is a company that caters to Boston sports fans. You know,
So what is it about Boston sports fans?
They're awesome.
No, seriously. You people are nuts. There's a bar in Santa Monica that has more Red Sox fans per capita than there are in this city.
I contribute to that.
Yeah.
You know, Boston sports fans they're passionate fans. And when we started, they were pretty angry. And, you know, we kind of catered to that anger and that passion. And our company started with this.
Right? So...
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. We'll actually
That's
have to
going
get a
on your office we're, door.
It actually is going on the office door. We're going to have to get a picture of this somehow. I actually didn't know this was coming. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So you guys started selling T-shirts, right?
We started originally with bumper stickers.
Yeah.
And we made
in a parking lot at Fenway.
That's correct. Yep. Yeah. We would sell items to the people leaving Fenway and leaving the garden later. You know, that's where our customers were. So. We tried to get in front of their faces.
Here's the bigger question, though. Come on, I'm doing this to be a good sport.
Take a picture.
When in somebody else's
Tweet
house,
it.
What do? You eat the Brussels sprouts when you're in somebody else's house. but here's the bigger question, right? This is all about business and community. I mean, you hit something with this company. Did you know that that's what you were doing?
No, I mean, we could not have picked a better decade to start a company that caters to Boston sports fans.
Which decade was that?
we started, it's our 13th year in business. We first went out in April of 2000, and, you know, it was just, it was just right before things started to hit, you know, the whole chant that that sticker was made for, we just hit at the right time.
Do you think you could have done that in any other sports town? I mean, you basically went from a parking lot to a million-dollar business.
You know, we couldn't have probably done it. Pardon?
Huh? Softball.
Softball.
Yeah, I mean, it's, Boston is such a great city.
Just
I mean,
coffee.
There's so many college kids, you know, so many people right. that, you know, I mean, we our mail order business is nationwide, and it's because so many kids come here for school, they, you know, live in a dorm right down the street, and become Boston, you know, sports fans, and then they take that with them wherever they go.
And then they freaking got you for life, and hello.
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, right, it's crazy, right? I mean, we have a colleague who she's the executive producer of this series of shows. And her dad took her to a Red Sox game when she was like 11. And now she's rabid. I mean, it's crazy. And you don't find that with Yankees fans or Dodger. I mean, you just don't find that. And I truly think it's all about community and the sense of place that Boston has that Phil was talking about, wherever Phil is.
Yeah. You know? No, I agree. I mean, I'm not from here, I'm from a town that really doesn't have any teams, so I adopted it quite willingly. But it's also, you know, I felt things in 2004 that, you know, my husband, who is from here, from Hull, felt the same way. And I was like, wait a minute, this is something new and different for me, but I still feel this incredible joy, you know, and it I think it's unique.
Yeah, no, it's been an amazing decade.
And I want a T-shirt.
Yeah. So one more thing before I let you go. What now? What? What do you do? You've tapped into this thing.
You know,
what are you building into?
We started obviously with the kind of anti-New York tip.
Yeah.
But okay. You know, we've grown into to all things Boston. You know, we have if you're a football fan, we got you covered. You know, with stuff like this.
I should say nice. I'm a Giants fan too, actually.
Nice. You know, the if you're a basketball fan or you know, we've got you covered. So
we've just gone
from all things, you know, Boston sports.
That's great.
Excellent.
That's great.
All right.
Well, Chris, thanks so much.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Awesome, dude.
Of Sully Brand. All right. Well, so you have heard the B word in this election, the budget, and this idea that, you know, if businesses can balance a budget, why can't the federal government? It's an excellent question. We're going to test that theory with a gentleman who's sitting here, and we'll get to that in a moment.
Also, what the candidates are not talking about, the silent issues that matter. Stay with us for more of the Marketplace. No horse, no race, election roadshow. Patty Hirsch coming up.
All right, so, you know, we have heard over and over again, essentially since the financial crisis came on our doorstep in 2008, that the government should be running the economy much more efficiently, more like a business. And that's one of the big arguments that Mitt Romney is making in his candidacy, and he goes to great lengths to point out that his opponent, President Obama, does not have that particular qualification.
When I became governor of Massachusetts, I took the skills I'd learned in business and went to look at our state budget. We were about $3 billion out of balance. I actually cut spending dollars in Massachusetts, and we balanced our budget and went from a $3 billion budget gap in my first year to over $2 billion rainy day fund.
So on the face of it, it sounds fairly reasonable, right? I mean, any economy is about bringing in revenue and spending it judiciously, or is
it? I'm going to have to pull you back a little bit here, Tess. I'm
Ladies
afraid.
And gentlemen, Patty Hirsch of the Marketplace Whiteboard.
Thank you.
And he's also, by the way, the author of a new book, Man vs. Markets, Economics Explained. Terrific new book. I highly encourage you to go and pick it up. Welcome to the stage.
Thank you very much.
All right. So the economy is not like a business?
Yeah, so here's the thing. A lot of people have this have been talking about...
Oh, pretty.
A lot of people talking about the economy, and we've had various sort of, I guess, people drawing various parallels with the economy in a household and economy in a business. And it's very clear that Governor Romney likes to sort of tout his business experience and say, well, an economy is just like a business, and that's why I'm sort of best qualified to run it. But in fact, economy in a business, it's not really a particularly fair parallel to draw. I mean, if you want to think about the... On the surface of it, it seems pretty obvious, right? You know, you have money that flows into a business, and money flows into the into an economy, and the money also flows out in the form of money goes into a business in the form of sales and revenues, and money flows into an economy in the form of taxes and you know that the debt that they borrow, and the money flows out in the company in the form of the expenses that it has, and of course the workers that it has to pay, but then it sort of flows back in. Likewise, in an economy, you have people. The economy makes money through taxes because it employs people. Once it's spent the money, it spends the money throughout the uh, the economy where people are given jobs and the all of these government spending programs that you hear about, then of course they pay taxes. So you have this nice kind of positive cycle of money through both an economy and a business.
In good times.
And of course in good times it's up to the CEO or the president to make sure that the budget is balanced. And so there's an obvious parallel there.
But when we have bad times come,
yes, things change a little bit, right? Because here's the thing. You've got less money maybe going in bad times because people are spending less. And, of course, in an economy, people are paying less in taxes. I mean, we know this because of the property issue. People are paying less in property taxes. So in both cases, there's less money going in to both the economy and also to the company. But in a company, of course, you can do a bunch of things really, really easy. Like maybe you can cut a bunch of the staff off here. You know, you can get rid of this lot.
Oh, all right? That's terrible.
Okay. Well, you know, it is what it is. You're in a company. You can have to do these things. Or maybe you have a product line. Maybe you build funny cars. Here's my car.
That's a car?
That's a car.
Okay, that's a car, everybody.
So maybe you decide, well, maybe we won't build like a whole line of cars. Maybe get rid of a whole product line. Or maybe you decide, let's stop actually building cars and let's make shirts. Maybe do a complete U-turn in the way that you actually do your business. And you can do this in a company. You can make these changes. It's a lot more difficult to do that in an economy. I mean, you can't put these people out of work. You've got these people on the right over here.
You know, you can.
Well, you can, but you really don't want to, right? Because, okay, so one of the things that you might decide to do is, well, maybe we should cut one of these big government spending programs. But more than 50% of the spending that we do in this country as an economy are on these mandatory programs, you know, Social Security and Medicare. These are programs that by law exist. You can't just cut them like a product line, all right? So maybe we should get some of the other spending. That's a sort of 45% of the spending in this country that's done through what we call discretionary spending. These are sort of unimportant things like, you know, healthcare and transportation,
education,
bridges. Defense spending.
Yeah,
you know,
we don't need that.
We could get rid of it. So now you're starting to see why it's a bit of a problem. You know, actually getting money in the door, it's one thing, but actually making the changes in terms of actually your spending is a lot more difficult.
And it seems to me that there's also a big difference in that with a company, if you're a CEO, you can pretty much just order anyone to do whatever you want them to do.
Exactly. Which brings me to my next illustration.
Excellent.
So here's our CEO. Okay, she doesn't look too happy. And she's a woman. I did one of these the other day, and I had a male CEO. I got into trouble. So, female CEO today.
I'd like to see the earrings and long hair.
The president remains a male. But here's the thing.
For now.
But in the... yes, I'm sure that's going to change. So, here's the thing. When you're in both of these situations, both a CEO and a president, they're sort of head of a pyramid of a pyramidical organization. We've got all these people reporting upwards, and the president and the CEO are at the sort of top of the tree, if you like. The CEO, okay, can walk around his or her company and say, "You in the stockroom, do business this way. You guys in transportation, stop doing what you're doing." And everybody will say, "Yes, yes, ma'am." They'll do exactly what she says all the time because she is the boss. Everybody reports eventually to the CEO. So whatever she says goes. When the president walks around Congress and, you know, the House of Representatives and the Senate and starts telling representatives to do things, they're like, we don't report to you, pal, okay? We report to the people. So in other words, the CEO can do whatever she wants and she can do it in any way that she wants to do it. The president, if he wants to get things done, has to walk around and be charming. He has to be persuasive. He has to have a whole bunch of skills that a CEO doesn't necessarily need to have, although some CEOs, of course, do have those skills. But the president has to have this whole skill set that a CEO doesn't really need. So making that sort of comparison between leading an economy and leading a business is really kind of a very mixed message and not a particularly good metaphor to use.
Economy is not the business?
Economy is not a business.
All right. Thank you, Patty Hirsch.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The photographer made me take it down. I'm just
sure.
Saying. For years, months, years, it just feels like months, I don't know. We've been hearing about things like jobs and taxes and government spending, but what else is on the minds of voters? What is missing from this year's political debate?
You know, our next guests actually have a few ideas of answers to those questions. WGBH senior investigative reporter Philip Martin, welcome to the stage.
Yes, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And Boston Globe business editor Shirley Leung, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. Sorry about
Good
that.
Job.
So Shirley, let's start with you. You know, President Obama and your former governor here, Mitt Romney, had their first one-on-one debate the other night, and they both discussed health care. And, you know, I wonder if you heard what you thought we should hear. Was there enough? Was there enough context, enough content?
I think what's really interesting about healthcare and what we call here Romney care is that Romney doesn't want universal healthcare. You know, he says that's the first thing he'll do when he becomes president. But here, you know, it was a signature moment in his political career as the governor here. I mean, he was very proud of passing that law here. He through perseverance, through, you know, work and crunching really tough numbers, he made it work. And it's a wild success here. I mean, even down to the point where when he had his official portrait done to be hung in the State House, he made sure he had the medical symbol painted in the background.
Is that right?
Yes.
Wow. That's
so he's
crazy.
Very, very proud of
that's
it.
Awesome.
I don't think he's pointing that out right now.
Yeah, well, so here's the question, right? Whose fault is it that we're not hearing more about that part of it, right? Because you hear it every now and then. Is it the media's fault? Is it the Obama campaign's fault? I mean, you know, it's a key issue in this election, whether we like it or not. Whether you like Obamacare or Romneycare or don't, it ought to be discussed more, and it's sort of not really. I don't know. Philip, what do you think?
Well, I think the Obama administration has admitted it's done a very bad job, and I mean very bad job of communicating its signature program, its signature legislation. And the juxtaposition to Romneycare is, as Shirley pointed out, it's pretty much exact. Even to the point where when you're talking about federal spending, Romneycare, and this is rarely talked about by Mr. Romney, it cost about $400 million from the federal government. That's and so it wasn't free, but the coverage has been extraordinary. 98% of residents of Massachusetts have been covered by Romneycare, and that's extraordinary. And so this notion of going to an emergency room, which was suggested by Mr. Romney last week, is actually in contravention to the very goal of his signature legislation. It's quite interesting.
What else, if you could have replaced Jim Lehrer on Tuesday night?
I'd replace him with Big Bird.
Please, replace Jim Lehrer.
No.
I feel so bad because he's such a nice guy.
No, I think Jim Lehrer did a better job than what people give him credit for.
All right, well, we can talk about that one in the question and answer afterwards. What else would you like to have heard that you did not hear in that debate?
Well, look, obviously you can't hear everything, but there are a lot of issues that never seem to come to the fore. You hear them in the context of some Senate races. For example, there's attention being paid now to Native Americans in our Senate race, but perhaps for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, for the wrong reason, right.
And I think what Native Americans, those I've spoken with, and I've been interviewing quite a few recently, have said is that they feel like they're being talked about, but not talked about.
Yeah.
Here's an example. I love that.
Here you have
a population group, according to 2009 census, has the worst infant mortality, the worst unemployment, both on and off the reservation.
Right.
And here they, again, are being talked about. Native Americans have made a difference in some Senate races. For example, in Arizona, they're expected to make a huge difference in the Senate race there, expected to make a huge difference in Montana, where both of these are very close races. And here in Massachusetts, you have 30,000 Native Americans just around the Boston area. Who would know that? And again, if this conversation takes place, according to the Native Americans I've spoken with at the North American Tribal Center in Boston, if this conversation took place in a way where they were involved in the conversation, they said they would make these issues clear to both the senatorial candidates and to both candidates for president. To focus on Native American issues, which seem again to have been obfuscated in this particular election.
Yeah, Tess.
Shirley, let me ask you what you think is missing from the debate at this point. I'll tell you one thing that I cannot believe is not being addressed is retirement. I mean, it's just non-existent as a topic of discussion in this presidential campaign, and I think it is potentially one of the major financial crises that we're going to run into, are already running into at this point. What are you seeing that you're frustrated that nobody's talking about?
Well, I mean, I think retirement is a big issue. I mean, I think probably because nobody knows the answer, so they're avoiding it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think what's really interesting is that Romney fashions himself as the CEO governor when he was here, and also the CEO president. Yeah. You know, and you know, his when you look at his record here when he was governor, you know, he had a mixed bag with businesses. He didn't have the best relationship with businesses. They were upset. They felt that he raised taxes on them. You know, he rightly so did close some corporate tax loopholes, but at the same time, businesses, even business allies, felt that, you know, it made Massachusetts even more unfriendly to business. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, he didn't have a great jobs record. I mean, granted, he like Obama, faced a very, you know, very slow recovery, so it was right. very difficult to create jobs, but he didn't create as many jobs as he would have liked to while he was here.
We're gonna open it up for questions here in just a sec, so please grab the attention of one of the mic runners, and you can put your questions to Philip and Shirley. I want to get back to the Senate race thing, since Philip brought it up a bunch of times, and I kind of joked about it in the open, that you guys can't quite make up your minds about this Senate race, right? It's Brown-Warren. And it's going to potentially decide the fate of the U.S. Senate. Why aren't more people coming here and saying, what's going on in the Senate race? I mean, Philip, clearly this is something you've been thinking about, this Senate race.
Well, people are heavily focused on the Senate race across the country, actually. As you said, Guy, it's believed that it may, in fact, determine which party controls right. the U.S. Senate. And it's pretty close at this point. There seems to be a horse race back and forth between Warren and Brown at the moment, as of today.
There's no horse, no race.
Right. No horse, no race. At the moment, it seems like Brown is slightly ahead. But I think, again, these are issues that have not... these are issues that have not basically been explored fully. Let me talk about this controversy again between Brown and Warren around yeah. Native Americans.
Native Americans. She claimed Native American heritage.
She claimed Native American heritage, Cherokee, and Brown said, prove it. You don't look right. Cherokee, is what he said, thus opening up a can of worms this whole issue of identity. On this issue of identity, what does a Native American look like? But again, Native Americans have said, well, I could tell you, but no one's listening. And what I would tell you is that we, this according to Native Americans, we represent every spectrum.
Right.
And so that has become a big issue, and it's an issue that people are focused on. So it's not as though people aren't looking at Massachusetts. In fact, there's a lot of attention focused on the state right now and on those comments.
I think that's the problem. I mean, the Native American issue, which, you know, the Globe has reported that we went back and interviewed people who've hired Professor Warren in the past.
Yeah.
And a lot of them said, we didn't even know she listed herself as Native American in these directories. We had no idea. We hired her on the merit of her scholarship.
Yeah.
And so this issue has dominated even the debates. It's the first question in the debates here. It's, you know, it dominates the political ads that are here. And really what we should be talking about is how are they solving the fiscal cliff? How are we going to prevent this major crisis in January?
Is that my phone? No.
I mean, that really, this Native American issue has just taken over the election, which is unfortunate because there are some real issues that need to be resolved at the Senate level.
Raise your hands because we want to hear actually what's on your mind. Yeah, right in the front, right down here.
Especially if there are topics that you're not hearing in the campaign, I'd be curious.
Or on Marketplace, for example. I mean, you know, honestly, who you are, where you're from.
Hi, my name is Samuel Bloom. I'm from Acton, Massachusetts. And my question is, in this election, I've seen it seems to be a preponderance of a lot of fact-checking, whether it be online or new, quote, nonpartisan independent studies that are coming out. In what way has that affected not only sort of the way people are perceiving the campaigns, but also on a quantitative level? How is that maybe changing the kind of polling that's being done? You know, is that changing the psychology that's used in terms of saying, well, are we going to say something that's going to be fact-checked every time?
But here's the most interesting part of that, and I'll let you guys have at that question. It's not actually changing what the campaigns say.
No.
It's not changing the Medicare ad. It's not changing what Obama says. I mean, it's not changing any of that stuff, which is crazy, man.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'll let the panelists answer the question.
Well, no, I think you answered it. I mean, it's astounding. I think one of Mr. Romney's operatives, in fact, mentioned that wasn't going to let the campaign be dictated by fact-checkers.
Yeah.
And, And you're right. And there have been outright fallacies on the part of both campaigns. factcheck.com say most of those fallacies, however, fall on the part of the Romney campaign, which extends from talking about welfare to discussions about Medicare. The Obama administration had an ally that ran an ad implying that Mr. Romney was responsible for the death of a woman who had passed from cancer, though that was not the fault of the campaign. But again, factcheck.com has been busy. Mm-hmm. Not just factcheck.com. Every fact-check operation in the country has basically said, you know.
Well, the last debate was fact-checked pretty much in real time, and it seemed to make really...
Well, the last debate was extraordinary because that particular debate, as we now know, Mr. Romney committed a number of...
Yes, but it didn't matter.
...of fallacies. Mr. Obama, President Obama, committed a fewer, but still, it didn't seem to matter.
Let's see if we can get one more very quick question from the audience right there in the back. And, sir, if she's going to yell at me if you go too long.
I'm Tony from Mansfield, and contrary... The Native American background goes to character. Contrary to what Governor Patrick says, the issue was not put to rest, and it hasn't been concluded. When Ms. Warren herself said that she was listed in Harvard as a Native American. Okay, so Harvard knew about it before she was hired. Also, she said, and on several occasions, that she listed herself because she wanted to be invited to lunch by
I'm not
Native
sure.
Americans.
Can we litigate this
Let
tonight?
Me just finish, please. Sure. Could I finish?
Sure. She said if you could wrap it up quickly, that'd
she
be great.
Said she was invited. She listed herself as a Native American because she wanted to be invited to lunch. When a Cherokee delegation came to Boston and I think came to North Carolina, to the convention, to see her and meet with her, she refused to meet with
her. Let me see if I can turn this
that
into
is
a
what
question,
I understand.
Sir, if I could, so we can move this on. Is the Native American thing going to decide the election for its Senate in the state of Massachusetts?
It won't decide it, but it's still important.
All right,
I think he's right.
Terrific, terrific. Thank you very much, guys.
Thank
Shirley Leung and Philip Martin from WGBH.
Thank you both.
Appreciate it. Thanks, you guys, very much.
So, as we all know, Boston is a college town, a lot of places to learn and study and ponder the what-ifs, perhaps more than any other location in the country. So, we are going to talk with two university officials on the state of the economy and higher ed and what the future holds for our students.
And what college students do from time to time once they turn 21, of course, they go out and have a little drink. We'll have a cocktail and a history of political cartooning and a conversation with a Boston businessman who brews his own success. All that coming up on the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Roadshow. We'll be right back. You guys good? You want some water? All right, okay, don't spill. All right, you all set? All right, good. Water, be careful.
So we could not come to Boston and not mention college and higher education, which has become an issue in this campaign.
There are more than 80 universities and private colleges in this city, as most of you probably know. And because of that, it has the highest percentage of college-educated young people in the country, which, of course, makes this an excellent place to talk about the value of a college education in today's economy. And, of course, whether it's worth the hefty price tag, which is a question that Tess gets asked on Marketplace Money, I think, probably every weekend.
Pretty much every weekend, yeah. So we've got not one, but two fine educational institutions represented here today. David Harris is provost at Tufts University. Welcome to the stage.
Thank you.
And Fred Lawrence is president at Brandeis. Welcome to the stage.
Thank you.
So prospective freshmen come and they take the tour and they meet in the admissions office and they look at the sticker and they say,
yikes.
And you guys say what?
Don't pay attention to the sticker. It's not a joke. I mean, one of the problems in higher education is getting our message across that while it's true at a place like Tufts and many other private universities, a surprisingly large percentage of the students are full payers.
Yeah.
And when I say surprisingly large, keep in the context that the cost of attendance for a year at many of these top institutions, private institutions, is about the same as the median family income in the United States.
Right.
So that's large.
$54,000 a year is the median family income.
But there are a significant percentage of students who are getting financial aid and getting an awful lot of financial aid. And so that's why I say, don't pay attention to the sticker. and fair probably enough isn't you.
Yeah, Kai, I think, David, enough, Fred, go ahead, yeah. I think David's right that about 2/3 of our undergraduates at Brandeis are on some kind of financial aid, and many of them are on a free ride. So, in fact, the sticker price, as we call it, is relevant only to about 1/3 of the students. The other thing we talk about, though, is the value proposition. You know, you have to look at this as a right cost that you're experiencing not just over the 4 years of school, but in fact for the rest of your life.
Assuming you can get a job.
Right.
Well, you can cost this out in a couple of ways. I mean, you can look at it, first of all, in terms of what it does mean in terms of the income of college graduates and yeah non-college graduates. So you can cost it out that way. But you can also cost it out in terms of the overall quality of their life, and maybe yeah even most important of all. You know, we're in a funny business. We are educating people for a world that we literally can't even imagine. Mm. So yeah the skill set that we give them today is, in fact, not the skills they're going to need, if by that you mean specific information. But if we teach them how to analyze, how to communicate, how to problem solve, and how to turn raw information into knowledge, then we've given them something valuable for years and years and years.
Which I completely endorse. I want to ask you one more thing about the cost proposition and what parents think about it, and then let's move on, because there's so much to talk about higher education in this country. I have a 14-year-old son who has become very enamored recently of my military background and in aviation. Until a year ago, he wanted to go to Stanford, tuition about $54,000 a year. And I was thinking, oh, my God, $250,000 for that. Came to me a year ago, and he said, Dad, I think I want to go to the Naval Academy. And I said, yes, I just saved $300,000. Does that make me a bad dad?
I think the answer to that question on the air is going to be you're a great dad.
But I mean, but that's what people think about. I mean, you think about it in the aggregate, and you're like, oh, my God.
Right. And, you know, I think you've got to put these things in context. Yeah. I have a 15- and 13-year-old daughter, so I appreciate what you're talking about. But when you think about loans for students, I think loans are a big issue. We have to focus on those loans. But one of the things I like to think about is people say it's extremely problematic if you have students graduating with $25,000 in loans.
Yeah.
Then ask yourself what many people do after they graduate. They go out and they buy an SUV. How much does that SUV cost and how big is your loan? How long will you have the SUV and how long will you have your education? So we have to keep these things in context.
Got it. Excellent point.
Well, let me ask, you know, we've had so many debates on the programs about financial aid and the loan system to get you through college. And one of the arguments that's been made, at least on our program, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, is that the system is broken because of financial aid, and that because of financial aid, colleges can charge more, and that this is basically a self-perpetuating problem. What's your response to that?
No, I know that argument. I think that financial aid makes it possible for us to be the gatekeepers of the American dream. I mean, I know that that sounds pretty corny, but the truth is that's what universities get to do. That we have among our student body people whose families have never been to college, and yet what happens to them in the 4 years of college, I'm sure it's true at Tufts as well, their lives are able to be changed by that, and that's because of financial aid. There are all sorts of constraints on universities in terms of costs, and we are not just dictated by the fact that we can charge because of financial aid. I mean, we are, in fact, a very high-quality good, and that's where a lot of the costs are coming from. Universities like mine and David's that have major science research programs, these are very expensive programs, but they have major benefits, by the way, not only for our students, but for the society at large.
But I think people still can't wrap their minds around why it's so expensive. And, you know, they're not going to go and look through all the budgets of, you know, everything from teachers to dorms to buildings and all that, but it does seem like the expense has just skyrocketed in the last decade.
I'd say two things about that. One is that you have to think about the revenue streams for universities. Tuition is one revenue stream people focus on an awful lot.
Right.
But it's only one revenue stream. Think about endowments. And the thing to realize about endowments for a university, I like to say that universities are like 80-year-olds living on a retirement account. They're not like 30-year-olds thinking about their retirement account. We're actually living on the income now, not thinking hopefully it will grow over time. As a result, when the market does what the market's been doing, we take a direct hit in our revenue. Another stream to think about is state governments. Think about not our institutions as much, but think about public institutions and how they've been affected, what's happened with state revenue. And the last one to think about is federal research funding. As Fred said, that's a big issue for universities like Brandeis and Tufts. As we've seen the NIH budget with the stimulus went up, those we're all expecting it to go down, those are further hits on the revenue system. Last thing to say, every university is one of two types. It's either a university that survived a crisis in 2008, or it's a university that sees a crisis coming in the next 10 years. Mm. So we are all having conversations about how to do things very differently, and people should realize that we're doing everything we can to try and get our costs down so they're as affordable as possible.
I think that's a key point. I think you guys need to hire new marketers, because I'm not sure that message is getting out.
No.
No, honestly, right? I mean, you hear people talking about the next big thing that's going to happen in this economy. People say, oh, student loan bubble, man. It's you know, you've heard non-performing home mortgage loans. Try non-performing student loans, right, at $1 trillion or something that's out there in the economy. I think that's a key point. Back to something that Fred said a little while ago about the quality of the education that is offered in America today. Is it easier now, given technology and productivity advances, for you guys to offer those educations, or is it tougher than when you and I were in school?
Both. I think there are things that can be delivered distance through the internet. I think there's information available through online that makes it easier in some ways to educate. On the other hand, I think there is more information out there. As I said, when I think about the major things that we can do, teaching students to turn information into knowledge is maybe the most important function that we can perform. When I was in school, there was just a lot less information available. But that doesn't mean that their information is any good. A lot of the information they get is, in fact, highly problematic. They're not all high-quality shows like yours, Kyle.
That's right. I know, right? So follow-on question. Is it harder or easier now to be a college student?
I think it's much harder. I think it's harder in part for the things we're talking about, and frankly, it's harder because the world that they're looking out into is a much less certain place and a much scarier place. When we have high school seniors coming on tours of campus and they want to know about the job placement center.
Oh, man.
I assure you, when I was in college, I didn't know that my college had a job placement center.
Well, and that's kind of sad, right?
Well, it's sad in a way, but on the other hand, I think it's also very realistic, and I think it is cruel for us in the administration not to take those concerns seriously. I think that's part of what we have to do and talk to them both about the general liberal arts education, but also where's it going to take them?
David, thoughts?
I think just follow up. I think there's a scary dimension you can ask, but there's also the excitement dimension. I think it's more exciting to be a college student now than it was 20 years ago when I was in college. What you're seeing is an explosion of interdisciplinarity, an explosion of student research teaming up with faculty that's far beyond what we experience, which means people are able to more often go beyond disciplines and go to the key questions that our society is addressing. And I think that makes this a very exciting time to be a college student.
This is a rare opportunity to ask these guys some questions, share your thoughts. We'd love to hear what you have to say. If you do have questions, raise your hands, and we'll get to you. If not, I'm sure. Yeah? Yes, ma'am, please. Pass the mic.
Just a question, Connie, from Newton. A question to both of you about the quality of preparedness of the candidates to come in, both from our school systems in the U.S. and from other populations, because we keep hearing in the media that they are perhaps more prepared coming from outside.
That's a great question.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that they're more prepared coming from outside. I do think that one of the big differences from when I was a student is the impact of international students on campus. About 15% of our undergraduate population are international students now, and they come from literally all over the world, and they are terrific both in terms of their background and the excitement that they bring. By the way, when people talk about the problems that America has, see, I'm watching people vote with their feet, and when there are people coming from all over the world to be educated in the United States, it makes me very bullish on the United States of America. In terms of our own students coming, including from your district in Newton and school districts all over the country we draw from, maybe schools like Tufts and Brandeis are in the privileged position that we're going to get about 8,500, 9,000 applicants for a class of about 820. So we're able to be quite selective, and the students we see are just top shelf. In fact, the hard part is of all the students who could do the work and could do well at Brandeis, we can't take them all.
David, last word?
Yeah, in fact, a university that is not Tufts, I had the following conversation with the head of admissions. I'll say it's not Tufts.
That one took a second.
Not clear. Hey, not Tufts.
It's not mine, is it, David?
No, it's not. The head of admissions told me that this school admitted about 5,000 students. This person said, I could take the 5,000 kids I'd admit, throw them out, admit the next 5,000, and nobody would ever know.
Wow.
That's how deep the pools are. So at a time where we're thinking about affirmative action and we're imagining that
your kid can make it
and so forth, there's so many people out there. It's a very complex situation about deciding who gets to go to these schools.
David Harris, he's a provost at Tufts, and Fred Lawrence is the president of Brandeis. Thank you guys so much for coming.
Thank you.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Really good session. Oh, are you really? And? He's a Yankee guy. He's a Yankee guy. Yes, you can offer me a beer. Jesus. No, I hope so. For some, or perhaps many of you, our next guest needs no introduction. It is possible You have tipped your glass or your bottle to him many a time. Rich Doyle is a co-founder and owner of Harpoon Brewery, which, when it started back in 1986, and I love this, was permitted as Boston Brewery number 00. Hey, my segment. My segment.
Thank you.
Wow.
Cheers.
Wow.
What a gentleman.
Harpoon is now the biggest brewery in the state, run by the nicest man in the world, clearly.
God.
So we've got 6.5 minutes to talk about beer, which honestly is not enough. But you started a business in 86 in this state, not the greatest of times. How'd you make it? What'd you do?
We survived. Mm. We stayed in the game. You know, the most successful thing is not getting knocked out. We learned a lot. And fought and stayed with it, and we're committed. Commitment,
and people who found you and loved you, right? It's like my T-shirt friend.
Yeah,
thank you very
much. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess the other great thing is we love what we do. We love our product, and we were in the right place. I mean, this is a terrific place to start this business.
Tell me why.
Was educated here, and got a good education, and both in beer and in general management, but the beer wasn't good enough, so we decided to do our own. So, you know, it's a great place for a lot of the demographic reasons you talk about. It's a place that believes very passionately about things that are of it, and it's also a place that bought a lot of beer and bought a lot of expensive beer, but it wasn't necessarily good beer. So we saw those things and thought, let's start a local brewery.
How did you do it? Did you go and find some beer guy? I mean, you were some young punk.
No, I was. I didn't know as much of a punk as I was, but
yeah, we never did.
No, you wrote a business plan. You know, I was in business school. Wrote a business plan. Two partners joined me, and we raised money. We hired a brewer.
Yeah.
And we got going. The four of us got going.
Did you see that chart in National Journal the other day talking about which is the most Democratic and which is the most Republican beer? Turns out, what is it? Heineken is the beer most favored by Democrats. Shiner Bock is the beer most favored by Republicans. And then they had craft beers in some little blue ball up in the corner, and they lumped them all together. Is it still that way in this country that craft beers are sort of shunted aside and only the aficionados know them, and everybody else drinks fizzy yellow?
No, I don't think so. I mean, we're moving from 5% to 10% of the market, and it's the hottest segment of the market, and all the big beer companies have a play in it. It gets a lot of talk value. It's very newsworthy, and it's moving.
So you know there was a financial crisis, right? And people cut back on discretionary expenditures and all that stuff. Did you take any of that hit?
You know, the financial crisis was actually good for our business. And I'll tell you why. And it's not for the reason
shocking.
That people think. It's not because people drink more in a
okay,
in
you know
a,
what?
In a
baloney, in a, but go ahead.
No, here's why. Because all of our raw materials were incredibly, the prices of which were all overheated. Stainless steel, glass, paper, malt and hops, everything, energy. And so in 2007, it was an awful year for us. 2008 was a much better year for us because all of our margins improved. All of our costs went down. All that overpressured because we can't reflect it. We can't reflect it in our pricing. Our pricing is actually, you know, is pretty elastic. So we couldn't. So that 2008 came and cost side went out.
Yeah,
and
it's pretty inelastic, right? I mean, if a six pack of my favorite Stone IPA, for those of you who are from the West Coast, goes up, you know, to like $13, I'm going to go and buy something else.
Correct. So you can't reflect the price.
Right, exactly.
You can't reflect the price increase. Right.
Where do you go from? Are you going to expand and conquer the world? I mean, what's the plan?
We're in 26 states. We're in half the country, and we're working hard in what we're doing. So it's been exciting. It's been a great run. It's been a great 26 years.
Can I ask you about Oktoberfest for a second?
Yes.
First of all, why is it not actually in the month of October?
You're talking about the one in Germany?
Yeah, well,
you have
to
ask them. They've been doing it for 600 years, so... You know, right. Believe me, you're not going to tell them. They're not going to change for you.
No.
I can tell you that.
So tell me about your Oktoberfest.
We have two. We have one in Boston, which was 2 weeks ago, and then one in our brewery in Vermont last weekend. And Hope people come out and see. It was a great thing.
You didn't tell the story I wanted you to tell, which is your original Oktoberfest. That was the we're going to throw everything.
Well, this was in 1990. I thought we were going to go out of business, and we decided to throw an event before we went out of business because I realized we had really good credit.
Right.
We could throw the event, and we didn't go out of business. So that's the good part of the story.
And so we sit here today, Rich Doyle from the Harpoon Brewery. Rich, thank you so much. Cheers. Really appreciate it. Thanks, man. Really appreciate it. Elections are often about things that are more symbolic than substantive. In fact, the candidates themselves are kind of symbols of their parties and what those parties stand for. But there are two political symbols, one for each party, that are honestly a little bewildering, a little confusing.
Just a little bit, just a little bit. Here to make sense of them is Brendan Francis Noonan. He is a Marketplace contributor, of course, and along with Rico Galliano, hosts the awesome public radio dream show, The Dinner Party. Welcome.
Thank you. Awesome. Thanks, Kai. Thanks, Tess.
You should listen to it.
Thanks, guys. I don't have any drinks for you to pay you back for that.
That's all right.
Endorsement. Thanks.
Why don't we start by telling the folks why you are here? Okay. Are we having a dinner party outside?
It was a free trip to Boston. I'm staying at the Charles Hotel. Right. I don't know if you guys stayed. It's
you know,
amazing.
You got to get up in the light.
Okay. I'm in the light. No, the reason I'm here is in our show, we have a signature segment called The History Lesson with Booze. Which
so we're going to have more booze.
There are going to be no more booze here. But there'll be a recipe. And what we do is we tell a historical tale, something that happened a particular week in history. And then we get a bartender to create a drink based on that cocktail, based on that history. It's an amazing segment. You should have thought of it when you dreamed of the Marketplace. But you didn't. So recently we did histories about the political mascots, the donkey for the Democrats and the elephant for the Republicans.
And I go back to my opening remarks, Counselor, which is a little confusing. Why?
Yeah, right? Okay. I mean, if you were going to pick mascots, right?
That would not
be it. You would pick like a tiger, you know, something powerful. Yeah. A falcon.
Bear.
A tiger
lion,
riding a falcon.
Something.
Which I think Joe Biden has tattooed on him somewhere.
That's a whole
actually.
Different thing.
Yeah, but you know what? The truth is the Democrats at least didn't pick their mascot.
It was foisted upon them?
It was foisted upon them by a Republican, Thomas Nast. He was an editorial cartoonist, a very powerful one. And in January of 1870, I think we have a slide here, this cartoon came up. The donkey had been associated with the Democrats before, but this is the one that really captured people's imagination. So what we're seeing here is, this is kind of a complicated story, but basically it's these Democratic newspaper editors kicking the corpse of a Republican lion. This is a famous Republican who had just died at the time. So
that's subtle.
Yeah, it's a little subtle, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not Willie Horton, but it is, it's pretty it's pretty powerful. And actually, this was effective. This captured people's imagination, and he continued to use the donkey. Other cartoonists started to use the donkey.
So he was a bit of a trendsetter.
That's right, to this day. And he was a real trendsetter. Beyond just the donkey, he created our current image of Santa Claus. Santa Claus used to be tall and skinny.
No.
Yeah.
Really?
That's true. That's true. He's not real.
Wow. Did he have a corn cob?
He's not real.
He's not real.
Button nose.
Sorry, we just broke Kai's heart.
Man.
Sorry. I'll get you a drink afterwards.
I need more beer.
We'll talk about it.
Jesus.
He was tall and skinny, and he made him fat and jolly.
Wow.
He also put the goatee on Uncle Sam, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
This is pre-Beatnik era, remind you. I don't remember.
So, all right. So if that's the donkey, then how do we get to the
all right.
GOP?
So
it
probably won't
elephant.
Surprise you to know that Thomas Nast also gave the Republicans the elephant.
That would surprise me.
It is surprising. I think we have a slide that will... This was the slide that really started the linkage between the Republicans and the elephant.
All right.
Another complicated story, but basically you can see the donkey with dressed in a lion costume kind of frightening the Republican vote there. The Republican, this big, powerful animal, is about to fall off a cliff there because of the... Because of the donkey.
So this is actually not a great portrayal of Republicans either.
Well,
basically cowards.
Well, you can see it, but on the other hand, it shows there's this big, powerful animal that is being frightened by this like dinky jackass. So
wow.
He was a Republican, remember? So this could explain why the Democrats never adopted the donkey. Officially, it's not their mascot. I mean, they use it, but they never
really. It's not officially.
Not officially, but the Republicans did adopt the elephant.
Because you take what you can get, right?
You take what you can get. I mean, yeah. It's just like, what? We'll just cut our losses, right? We could have a chinchilla or something weird if we stick around. So that's it. That's the story of these guys.
It's a good story.
All right. So I believe we have a gift for the audience.
We do. So our show, we had
look under your chairs.
We had a bartender. No,
not really. Not really. Not really. Not really. Not really. Not really.
You'll see a picture of Kai and Santa Claus from 5 years ago.
Skinny Santa Claus.
He is so
skinny
real.
Skinny Santa Claus. No, so we had a bartender at this wonderful bar, The Passenger in Washington, D.C., create a drink based on this history. It's called the Jackass Neck, which is based on a classic cocktail at the time called the Horse Neck. So you can find the recipe, and you're welcome to make the drink. And I'm at the Charles, so come on.
That's right. Brendan Francis Newham, he and his buddy Rico Galliano. It's a show called The Dinner Party. You should listen to it. It's good stuff. Nice job. Really good job. Boom.
All right. And that is the Marketplace No Horse, No Race Roadshow. Devin Maverick Robbins produced our program with help from Millie Jefferson and Bridget Bodner. Nancy Fergali is the Roadshow Executive Producer. And our engineer is Bradford Craig.
Special thanks, of course, to WGBH for hosting us and the great audience here in Boston. We appreciate you guys coming out. The executive producer of Marketplace is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is Vice President and General Manager. You can check our website for more of anything you heard tonight. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tess is going to take us out.
And I'm Tess Viglin. Thanks so much for coming.
All right. So, there we go. Oh, the mic is back there. Thank you so much for coming. That was...
Hope you had fun.
That was Imperfections and All.
Cheers.
That was Imperfections and All, minus the beer. What happens around Marketplace every afternoon about 2 o'clock. Slight pandemonium, some miscues, and then we fix it and you guys never know. Our panelists are here. I'm sure they would be happy to take some questions for about 10 or so minutes. And then Phil's going to come up and say a couple of quick words, but... So did you enjoy it? Was it good? People always say, what was it like? Yeah. I come out of the studio every afternoon, and people say, so how was the show? And I'm like, I have no idea. I'm not actually listening to the show. I'm listening to Devin or Millie or whatever it is. Tell me what to do, where I'm going next. So please, raise your hand. Yes, ma'am, in the middle right here in the front. It's going to be a battle of mic runners. I know. That's the flow with mic runners. Let's pass it over. There we go. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Carol from Brookline.
Hi, Carol.
Hi. I'm wondering why, and I assume that our Boston Globe and
they're all still here. You bet. We'll bring them up.
Why they think that Mr. Lehrer never asked a question about women's health and the Ooh. Blunt Amendment and what's going on with Planned Parenthood?
I Who mean,
there's all those
one?
Things Philip, that never came up.
I could try to.
Do your best.
I think the question really is. I think the question really is why the president didn't focus on those issues. And that seems to be at least the question that seems to be coming from his supporters and from as well as from Mr. Romney supporters. I think they were surprised that those issues didn't come up. As for the moderator, I obviously can't peek inside Mr. Lehrer's mind. I think when I said he didn't do as bad a job as people have pointed out, what I mean to say is that it could have been worse. I'm very serious. Let me tell you why I say that, because it's not an excoriation of Mr. Lehrer. That is to say that I think what I mean by that is that he could have, in fact, yes, been more assertive and asked other questions. But I think he was seriously trying. It's one of those conundrums of journalism. And I think Kai and Tess can talk about this. You know, where you are trying your best to be right down the middle, and as a result, you end up sometimes being more sanitized as a moderator than you should. That's my view.
So I don't doubt that. But here's my view. As you know, I've never moderated a presidential debate. But you know, you do a panel discussion, and a well placed "Oh come on," really works wonders, right? And Anyway, next question. Anybody?
Right next door.
Just keep that mic right there, and we'll just, you guys can go all day.
Hi, I'm Sir. Howard. I'm Howard from Brookline, and I have a question for the education panel.
Yes.
Do they think that part of the cost, the rise in cost, is what I call the amenities conflict? Mm.
It's the fancy dorms, it's the nice
Avenue
gyms.
You see these huge dormitories and sports centers and gyms, and yet, and does this contribute to the fact that education costs has risen at two or three times the rate of inflation in the last 10 years or so?
And are those things expected now by incoming students?
Yeah, right. I'll take a first crack at that. I'm sure David has other thoughts as well. I think yes, but I think less than it was even just a couple of years ago. I mean, just 30 seconds of a history lesson on this. You go back before 2008, and there actually was enormous pressure coming from Senator Grassley in the United States Senate on universities to spend more of our endowments. They said we were hoarding endowments, you weren't spending enough. The joke after the crash of 2008 is, well, we solved that problem. You know, nobody's pushing us on that anymore. But as a result, it was a lot of money being spent, and you get into an arms race on quality of the dorms and on the facilities for the arts and facilities for athletics. And then the hard part for us is to figure out which part is really critical for the academic enterprise and which part a lot less so. So I think what we're seeing is a lot less of that from students now. You still get some of that. I mean, they want to see sort of a minimum quality, but a lot more discussion about the quality of the academic program, a lot more discussion about where they're going to go when they get out, what kind of skills are they going to get. But you raise an important point. I just think it's a little less true than it was a couple of years ago.
David, thought?
Yeah, I think it's important not to look at higher ed in a vacuum. So something people may not be aware of, but you probably do understand, is that in the last 20 years, if you look at average income in the top 5% of incomes in the U.S., it's more than doubled. If you look at the size of the average family home in the last 30, 40 years, a huge increase. And so part of what's going on is that folks are saying, when my kid goes to college, they shouldn't live as well as they do at home, but they shouldn't live that much worse. Well, that much worse for people who are paying $60,000 out of pocket is a lot different than it was 30 years ago. And so that's part of the pressure you're seeing on universities.
Great. All right. Thank you very much. We'll get one more, and then Phil Rito is going to come up and say goodnight to you guys. Yes, ma'am, in the middle.
Hi, my name is Babs. I'm from Everett. One of the questions for the education panel is how much is the effect of the open courseware movement for universities like MIT and also the increase in for-profit education colleges and universities? What effect is that going to have on what have been traditional nonprofit bricks and mortar universities? And is it likely to increase or decrease the cost or even level the playing field a little more?
I'll start. This is one of the huge questions in higher ed. Every university is thinking about this. If they're being responsible, they're thinking about this. One of the key questions is, to what extent are the MOOCs, which is the massively online open courses, I think is what it stands for,
wow.
MOOCs. I have to say MOOCs in my position. I didn't think I'd have to say that. to what extent are these MOOCs part of the residential education initiative? And to what extent are they separate businesses for higher ed? And that's what we're having to debate right now. And people are seeing this in very different ways. And it affects your principles are at play here. And it affects very much whether you decide to get in, and if so, how you decide to get in.
I think to a certain extent, they're going to put pressure on some parts of what we do, but not other parts, which is to say, you know, large lectures are very much amenable to being picked off by that kind of an education. The small class, the discovery opportunities, the research opportunities with grad students, with postdocs, the professors, much, much less so. But this is a very different world for our students. I mean, I'll tell you, I've got students on campus, one part of campus to another. They've got a study group at night, and it meets on Skype.
Wow.
Now, I will tell you that to me, wow. I will always hear my mother's voice saying, it's too nice a day to play indoors, go outside. But I run this past my two best consultants on this, my two kids who are both in their 20s, and I said, hey, is this one of these things where I'm right and they're wrong, or is this one of these generational things I got to get used to? Yeah. And they sort of have the body language that says, Dad, this is one of these generational things you got to get used to. The plus is that if they can do Skype on campus from North Campus down to one of the quads on the lower campus, then they can also do a Skype study group from there to Bangalore or from there to Tel Aviv.
Which is cool.
So that's very cool.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you
all for coming.